This is an interview of Mrs. Olive Dineen, conducted by Kathy Meehan on July 7, 1973, for Texas A&I University. In the interview, Mrs. Dineen discusses some of her early experiences in Corpus Christi, the hurricane of 1916, and the hurricane of 1919. Mrs. Dineen, when did you come to Corpus Christi?
October 19, 1907.
How did you come to Corpus Christi?
I came on a tourist car. They were called homeseekers in those days. My sister was ill, and the Mayo brothers had recommended coming south away from electric storms. So we came with these homeseekers. And we arrived here at 7:30 at night, and father and brother had come on ahead. The furniture and so forth, and he met my mother and took her to this rooming house, which was called the Leatherwood Rooming House. Mr. Leatherwood was a retired Methodist minister, and he was running a dry goods department store, and he had his home and rooms above the store. So I stayed on the train with my sister until the next morning, which was Sunday, and that was my first Southern hospitality meeting. As I was going up the stairs, Mr. Leatherwood was coming down, and he said, "Good morning. Have you been to church?" And I replied, "No, sir." And he said, "What's wrong with you? You ashamed to be seen with us rebels?" Well, I was shocked because, to me, the war was something that you read about in history. Well, my next introduction to Corpus was I was told I had taken a secretarial course and I was planning on going to work, I hoped, in a law office. And I was told that girls in the South did not work. I then learned that you were not accepted until your background had been thoroughly checked. Corpus was a place between 7,000 and 8,000 people. And, of course, they had their little 400 and all, and I had all that to learn. Strange as you look back, I thought there wasn't a sidewalk in the town. It was more of an oyster shell, and then it was covered with white shell, tamped so that it was hard. And, of course, lots of dust accumulated, but not too much mud in the downtown part. And there were very few two-story homes. I lived in the first time in my life I'd ever lived in a one-story house. And there were shutters at the window, no window screens, and very few door keys. People didn't have to lock their houses. And they had mosquito bars over the bed, and that draped around the bed. The mosquitoes were bad, as I learned. The following month in November, I had dengue fever. And if you've never had dengue fever, I'll tell you, every bone in your body breaks. What do you think? That was number two. Then I had been used to a riding horse. And there were very few riding horses here. The only riding horses you saw was when the cowboys came in off of the ranches on Saturday night. That was disappointment again. And I tell you, I was ready to leave. And I went to work for a law firm that was just starting in business, Parker and Duncan. And they asked me what typewriter I would use. Well, I had been trained on an Underwood. And I found out there was no Underwood in the town, but they got one for me. And a Miss Rains, who was secretary for J.E. Garrett, said she'd like one. So we had the first two Underwood typewriters in the town. From then on, the Underwood people would send their salesmen to me to get names of people that might be prospective customers. And at 1912, I remember that because it was a leap year, and Dick Schindel came here. And I was rather hesitant about asking. We had to ask a boy to this leap year party. Mm-hmm. And it was a Sunday school class. And I asked Dick if he would like to go. He did. And Dick stayed here, and his son is still running the business.
Yeah.
And that was the first. And then as I said, Parker did not last very, stayed very long. I went to work for Suttle and Todd, lawyers. And up until 1890, there was a cloud on the land title. And Mr. Suttle developed the idea of abstract, of going to the courthouse and drawing off the records. And I cut them on a wax stencil, and we mimeographed. They had a 50-year limitation, and they gave them a title. See, this land, there was two leagues of land that was given to Henry Kinney by Enrico Villarreal of the state of Tamaulipas. And in between, when the Corpus Christi Land Company, in 1890, when the Roach boom came and they began to sell land here, there was no clear title. So Mr. Suttle drew off the records, and I mimeographed them. And from that on, they came into, that was the first part of the abstract. And then they began to, Mr. Suttle married and left here, and I think Mr. Wakefield bought him out of what he had started, and he started the Southwestern Abstract Company. And from then on for years, all those, until they began to give title policies like we get today, all those early mimeograph copies were mine.
Interesting.
And then while I was working on that, Dr. Turpin brought a patient in from Alice in a boxcar with smallpox. And then somehow or other that spread, and we had an epidemic here in 1909. And I happened to be a victim of the smallpox. And after I recovered from that, I went to work for the Rankin Hill Company. Mr. Sidney Allen was auditing their books, and he worked for the Corpus Christi National Bank and did the auditing on the side. And he asked me if I wouldn't accept this position. He said, there was trouble with the books. And he said, when it comes time to count the cash, I know the man is going to leave. And he said, would you take his place? And I said, I'm not a bookkeeper. He said, that's the reason I want you. I want to teach you my way, and I'll be responsible. So I went to work for Rankin, Crane and Hill, wholesale groceries. And that was in a adobe building, two-story adobe building that had been built by Mr. N. Gussett, an early pioneer here. And he had a bank in conjunction with his he shipped, he had boats, and as I understand it, and shipped out hides and wood and so forth. And he had this vault there that was in the building, right? And our office walls were, in the summertime, it was canned goods that made two walls in the back part of that building. And in the wintertime, it was ammunition that made the walls. And that brought Mr. Rankin had been in the retail business, and he had always had an idea he wanted to go in the wholesale. So he had bought out Captain Fitch. And Captain Fitch's daughter married Ed Crane. And Ed Crane and a Mr. Tom Hill were salesmen for Ullman, Stern, and Crotsey out of Galveston. And Mr. Rankin and G.R. Scott, as a silent partner, bought out Captain Fitch, and then they brought in Mr. Crane and Mr. Hill, and with the understanding that the profits would go into the purchase of their stock in And that's where it got its start and its name. Well, then came the 1916 storm. And it came up about, started about the noon hour. Mr. Reagan had gone home from dinner. And he came back, and about 2 o'clock, the wind began to blow high, and his daughter began to go, "Papa, come home. And we're afraid the front door's going to blow in." Well, they were so frightened, he left me there and the shipping clerk. Well, in a short time, the shipping clerk's family were pleading with him to come home. And I had charge of the money, and I had to wait for the driver to bring in the money from the deliveries that he had made. Well, the storm by 4 o'clock was so I could not go home. And Mr. Ed Grant, who lived on Water Street, came over and he had all of his papers and silverware and so forth, and he said, "Can I put this in your vault?" So he stayed there with me and the driver, and we stayed there. By that time, they were coming from north part of town, and we took people in. Some of them went up to the Nueces Hotel, but they were sour the next morning because there were a great many windows that blew in the Nueces Hotel, and we were dry because we were facing the west, and the back door was open. We had to suction all the way through, and there was no trouble at all. And Mr. Grant had been through what they call high winds over on the island, and he said, "Now don't worry, it'll reach its worst at 11 o'clock and break, or it'll grow worse." Well, by 11 o'clock, it did subside. And we went across the street and got our dinner at 12 o'clock that night. And Major and Mrs. White were one of those that we took in. And Mrs. White sat in a chair for 14 hours and never moved. And after that, every Christmas, I got a card from her, "From your all-night sitter." But we watched the people as they went, and they were trying to cross the street from the corner where the Continental bus is now and get across to where Levine is. Well, it would take 4 and 5 men. They would take arm by arm to get them across. One more person couldn't go. The wind was so high. And it, of course, we were in, near the center of the block, and the Episcopal Church was on the next corner. And at 4 o'clock that afternoon, the steeple fell from there. And that's the first time we had ever heard of a hurricane. It had always been called a big blow or a big wind. And if there was a big wind, they rang the bell on the city hall, market hall, where La Retama is now. And that was to call the fishermen off the reef. So that was our 16th storm, and that wind, it was a hard rain and a steady blow. And there's always been a great discussion. I was down in town for the 16th. I was on the bluff for the 19th. And before we became what they call Spartan City, it was said, and the city grew, we always pictured ourselves, the bay, as the shape of a horseshoe. And Corpus Christi was the toe, the center of the city was the toe of that horseshoe. Well, in the toe of that horseshoe, all the way up the bluff, nothing was ever hurt at all. I lived 2 blocks back on the bluff, and there was never any damage up there. And when the 19th storm came, it came in gusts. It started in the morning, raining, and then there'd be a gust of wind, and then there'd be sometimes a long period before you could get another heavy wind. And my house faced north, and I had casement windows. Well, the rain came not down, ordinary rain, it came horizontal. It just cut in under those windows. So I mopped up. I got kind of tired, and I took my rug and rolled it and put it up on my dining room table. I got a rocking chair, and I put my feet in another one, got a book, and I read. I had no idea what was going on down below That's why I contend the 16 storm was worse. When I tried to go to my office the next morning, I saw that I was just in the 19th storm. I was just a half a block back of the Corpus Christi Cathedral now. And the roof was all lined with people, and they were all looking down into the tower. But when I got up there, I found I could not go down. By that time, Mr. Rankin had sold out Rankin Hill Company, and I had gone to work for Ullman, Stern, and Krause, who were on the opposite corner of Cooper's Alley and Chaparral Street. Couldn't get down the bluff, and I walked back, and where our city tax office is now was a telephone office. There was a small sailboat in front of that telephone office, and the old Japonica, which was a pleasure boat, was up on the pavement on South Broadway, where the back of Edmund Flaper's home. It was just right up on that. It took 6 months to get it back into the bay. The engine back. And when I got up in front of the Presbyterian Church, that was built as a memorial to Mrs. King's husband, Miss Henriette, and it was a beautiful church. And Miss Mildred Seaton, who was president of the Red Cross at that time, was out in front of the church. And of course, connected with groceries, I guess that's the first thing that went in my mind. I said, Miss Mildred, how are they going to feed these people? She said, that's your job. I didn't question whether it was my job or not. I knew that I couldn't get to Hillcote Pope and I couldn't get to Ullman Stern, and I knew that Gross Parish was back. It was across from what was then the old Sand Depot. And then it later became the Missouri Pacific down there. And there was Gross Parish was across the, well, it was just a lake of water at that time on the other side of the railroad track. And I could see, they were built up on stilts high from the ground, and I could see men working. So there was a large colored man there, and I turned to him and asked him, could he call over there and have someone come over where I could talk to them? He said, lady, I'll carry you. I assure you, I was a little hesitant, a colored man carrying me. But he showed he could take me by my elbows. And he waded through that water and took me over. Mr. Charles Ferguson was the manager. And he gave me coffee and sugar and crackers and cookies and cheese, anything that was edible without cooking at that particular time. So then the problem was to get it up to the church. And I started back, and it kept on raining. You couldn't hold a parasol over you. The sun would come out, and then it would rain. The sun would come out, and it would rain. So I got halfway up that hill, where the front of where the Call of Times is now, and this Mexican man with a little gray was coming down, and I asked him, would he go again? He went over and got him, brought him up to the Presbyterian Church. So that became a commissary. And we had 700 people there to feed those first 2 days. And first the local Red Cross was trying to do it, and then the National Guards came in, and then the city was going to run it, and then the National Red Cross came in. Well, they opened up over on Leopard Street, where Braslaw is now. The Loving Schools had that corner. The corner was Mr. Fred's, in the middle was Mrs. Southgate's, and the other was her sister, Mrs. Alice Rankin. And Mrs. Rankin had donated the use of her store building, which was vacant. And it was to be used by the Knights of Columbus. They were going to open up something there. Well, the city condemned it, so they couldn't put any people in there. So Mr. Fred Roberts and Mr. Locker and a few others, they opened up a receiving station for all of the food that was sent in from Laredo and Brownsville and Kingsville and all these various places that sent in food. And then I would have to go over there and give them an order. Well, I'd go and get the order before it could be delivered, somebody else would get in charge. And I'd have to go back and sign papers again before they could take it. Well, the there were 50 people at the courthouse. That morning, they were able to have their breakfast on account of the food being there for the jail. And over at the high school, there were 350 more people. Well, as I say, 700 at the church. I would have all of the food sent over to the Presbyterian church. And Mr. Walker, who was a salesman for Hill, Cook, and Pope, he came up to help. I would go and find out what the need, then give him, and he would ship it out to the different places. Well, the afternoon of the second day, I got back, and there was two Dr. Caldwell's brothers and sisters, and Miss Milton, that were head of the Red Cross local. And they called me in and told me that I was to go and pacify the Catholics, that they wanted a part in it, and the place they wanted to set up had been condemned. And I was to go over and open a kitchen for them. Well, that was a peculiar position to place me in, because I was so much younger than any of the others. So I said, "You mean to say I'm to do it?" She said, "You're to do it. Don't come back and ask us anything." So Dr. Caldwell had suggested a certain lady, I won't mention her, she has too many relatives here, but she was a very nervous person. And so I decided that Miss Mary Carroll, who was a teacher and well-known, was the best qualified. And she was working with Professor Wisely at the high school. I went over and asked him, would he spare her? And he said, "Well, she's at home resting now, but I'll send her a message. I have the letter yet that he sent to her and told her to report to me." On the bottom, she said, "Yes, we'll serve Mary Carroll." And she went over to what was known as Charity Hall. It was back of the old St. Patrick's Church. And they had a new priest there. The World War was just over. And he was still in his uniform. And I didn't know him. And truthful, half his parishioners didn't know him either, with an army uniform. I walked over to him and I said, "Can you tell me where to find Father O'Leary?" He said, "You're looking at him." And I said, "Well, I've come over to see about opening a food kitchen." And he threw his wrench to the ground. He said, "What next? I've just finished fixing up that building to put people in." I don't know where the inspiration came from, but I said, "Oh, but you don't have to change that. Just go in the building back of it and they can cook in there, and the tables are here in the yard and they can go cafeteria." First sensible thing I've heard. So that was settled, and I went down to Wild Brothers and knew then what to get. I had 2 days of experience, and Mr. Alec Wild, they sent up tubs and he got everything that was necessary to run a food kitchen that was sent up there. And then he had the cabbage and so on and so forth that had come in and had them there that couldn't use. There was no gas. People that had gas in their homes were working in the food kitchens. People that had servants at home were cooking for the others. And so we had the best kitchen over there, and we transferred 350 people over there from the church. That left them more room for their information books and all. And I heard of Mr. Green's Red Cross. And he was so nervous, he said that he had been given orders to kiss 2 times instead of all. Very young man, David, became commander in the submarine. He is now retired. And so still. And then we went up. The manager of the Armstrong was insisting that I return to the office that I was moving. So the Red Cross was at an order of conscription. I couldn't go back. And then Mr. Aaron Wright came down to San Antonio, and he told me that they would release me and would bring me to it and they said. By that time they had set up that you could all take care of it. It was going to take the fortune. And So I went back to the understanding that I was to come back after 6 o'clock at night. But so much had been given to me, free, that I couldn't bear in mind all of those things. So I got a ledger and kept track of everything that was given to me and everything that I had signed orders for, which was turned out to be a very smart thing. Because people that had given me those things later, when they found the international Red Cross, they came in and took them to bed. So, that's my history with the Red Cross. Up until 1990, we don't use the Red Cross. That's the electric technology they had from 1910. And Mr. Heinrich, he had married Beth Harris. And they were putting up the wire along the Capitol Street. And my mother was a big student. And they couldn't understand. My mother told me that she didn't tell them about the rods that runs along the wire from the telecom. And mother said, oh, well, it just comes from that. And then when the car did start running, it was amusing to watch the people, especially the Mexican children. They would get down on the pavement and look under the car, all around, to see what it was running. All the tracks there, how it ran, of course, there were two tracks there for the wheels to run. And there's an interesting story about the change of name, the Street Rabbit Club, recent years. But it got its name from the mayor at that time, was Dr. Stephen. And he lived on Angela Street. And he crossed the street according to go to Mrs. Mayor. And the cow, he didn't know, was behind him, and ran in the street car, killed the cow. So in settling the claim, Dr. Sidney had some farm land down at the lake town, and they ran the street car down there, and they called it the rabbit run. That was his compensation for the death of that cow. I think it's interesting when you know where it gets its name.
This concludes the interview with Mrs. Dean.
And then the Spahn Hospital, they were built, and that's an interesting thing too, where our deep water is now. Originally, it was called Bio. And that separated the town from what later became North Beach. And that was where the slaughterhouses were. A man by the name of Hall had slaughtered planes up there. And after the 16 storm, they had filled in that Hall's bio and made it all land. But when the 19 storm came, it washed that up just as clean as could be. You would never know there'd ever been any land there. And in that way, the people from North Beach were stranded. They couldn't get across. And when they did get, the part of the Spahn had one little part standing, and part of Jed McDonald's home was standing, and the Caruth, Dr. Caruth had his home and a sanitarium connected with it. I know. From my recollection, that was all that was left. Before that, Colonel Dickinson, this is G.R. Scott's brother, was a promoter, and he came down here and built the what was known as the Beach Hotel, and sold land up there, and there were 600 homes built. Well, after the 19 storm, all was left was those three that I've just mentioned. And the deep water port is where Hall's bio was. The 19 storm, as I said, I knew nothing about it until the next morning. It was a tidal wave. And that wave came in about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I had friends that were living on the bayfront, and it had a retaining wall in front of it. And they had the mother, who was Mrs. Oakman, Miss J.B. Oakman, and her daughter Adele, and they had put on their bathing suits and were lying out back of that just to watch, and they saw these two big waves coming. And they hurried into the house, and as they got to the back of the house, that wave had struck the front, and the house was demolished. And Adele had a pony called Gypsy, and she got on one side of the pony and her mother the other, and that pony swam them out over to the courthouse. And there wasn't a thing that showed how heavy that wave was. It demolished that home completely. And the oil was another thing that made that bad. The oil drums broke over at Port Aransas, and it came in on that wave. And so much of the downtown was covered with that, and people that those that drowned were covered with that slimy black oil. I was asked to identify someone. I said I could, but honestly, I would never try to identify a drowning person again. They're not, you can't recognize them. And one outstanding thing about that storm were that people were in shock. I just can't explain it. But you never heard anybody crying. And people were asking what they could do. They were offering their services. The one thing that always stood out in my mind, there was a lady from, I think she was from Barcelona, Spain. And she was stopping at the Nueces on her way to Mexico City. She had two brothers in the banking business there. And there had been some entertainment the night before at the hotel, and she was beautifully dressed. I can't recall ever seeing a lovelier black lace dress than she had, and she had some lovely jewelry, you know. And she and the wife of a coffee salesman, sold our local coffee, were sitting out in the vestibule of the church, and I came in and they said, "Isn't there something we can do? We are so helpless." And Mr. Weil had given me, the Weil brothers used to have the delicatessens there, and had some that would make hams and they would slice them off. And he had given me this ham and these ham bones and all other things. And he gave me, he had six or eight sacks of beans. And he said, "Now these beans are edible, but they must be cooked right away." I said, "Well, send them up to the church." So I asked this little bride, I said, "Can you cook beans?" She said, "Yes, I can try, anyhow." And I turned to this other lady and I said, "I don't know a thing to be done, but those hams have to be sliced." And she said, "I can do that." You can imagine my feeling. And so then the thing was to find Miss Jessie Griffin, Miss J.H. Griffin, said, she was looking after the kitchen, and she said, "Ollie, you've got to get those beans out of here. They're going to smell." So I went over and I asked the lady who lived in the next block to loan me her copper boiler. They used to boil their clothes in those copper boilers out in the yard. And she said, "No, she'd never get it back." And I persuaded her that I'd be responsible, so she let me have it. And they cooked the beans, and they cooked cabbage and the different things, and they had, that's where they got their meals. Then people, they were passing it around like they were guests, and I told them, "Miss Jessie, I can't get enough food." And she said, "Well," I said, "you got to do serve them some other way, and I don't keep giving them something." She said, "Well, that's the only way they'll eat." I said, "Learn them up cafeteria stuff." She said, "They won't eat." I said, "Well, if they get hungry." So they ate too. But you know, the funny thing was, some of those people asked for napkins and toothpicks. Now, that's my recollection of the 1919 storm. I was on duty for 2 weeks. Then they, one night, as I started to say, they brought the Kennedys turned their home over to the hospital. And the sisters came into the Kennedy home where the cathedral now stands. And on the large lawn there, the soldiers, of the National Guards, they were in tents. Well, I don't know what they ate that night, but they got ptomaine poison. And the call came in to the church to come and bring all the utensils we could bring. There was a Mr. Thames, who was head of the Boy Scouts, came up here from San Benito. And he started out loading down with the utensils and I with a flashlight. And of course, we had our Red Cross badges on our arm. And when we got to the corner of where the Wilson building is now, I don't know whether I should tell this or not. There was a young man standing there and plays the saying, "Halt, who goes there?"